The key was in the door. There was mud on his trousers. Carl's life had become a series of scenes, featuring Carl. They joined up for a second, like words made of rain in the pox of a path, then came apart again. Everything was like an answer that was on the tip of your tongue. Coats, tiny flowers of the wallpaper. He could not remember how things join up. The bodies, the shadows, a thousand, a million, going, "We are the dead." So loud, the horrible sound, the druid staring at Carl with his mouth open. Then in a glow, dead boy, at their front. That's when Carl ran. He ran all the way back home. The living room smelled like chemicals.
"I love the smell of napalm in the morning."
Light shot at you from everywhere. Gleam, gleam went the wood and glass, the TV, the rowing machine, the gin bottle. Through the dark. On the couch, Mom lay. From the doorway, it looked like a fairy tale with a princess fallen asleep in an enchanted garden. The curtain was open. The street light shone on her bare legs. Carl reached down and very gently, like he was plucking a flower, took the burned-down cigarette from between her fingers. He carried it to the fireplace and put it there. In the kitchen, he poured water into a glass. He held up the glass and looked into it. In the glass, the room, the cream walls, the grey refrigerator, the cookery books with famous TV chefs on the never-opened covers, all shivery and blurred. He drank and felt the room wobbling icy cold in his stomach. Now when you open your eyes, there will be nothing there. "Carl!" He opened his eyes. He was in the living room. Mom rose silver out of her sleeping body and floated above it. She watched Carl but did not speak. The moon was full. They had turned it into a streetlight. She looked down, sad like something terrible was going to happen. But it was not she who said Carl's name. Standing right next to Carl was Dead Boy. "Oh, fuck!" Now when you stared at him, he did not disappear any more. That was what happened on the hill. That was why Carl was screaming. You screamed and screamed, "Fuck off!" And, "I'm sorry!" He just hovered. He just smiled. Now he was here in Carl's house. There was nowhere left to run. "He is dead. I've been wanting to talk to you," he said. "He can talk?" "First you have to smoke the poppies first. Then I can talk to you."
"Huh?"
"The poppies are made of, in the war they grew out of, the bodies from the land of death. People spat on them, so they moved underground, to give them anterograde amnesia. So, when you smoke them, now you can see us."
"Do you live in the dolmen?"
Carl said. Dead Boy nodded. "It is very cold," he said.
"Yes, that is what they said."
Now he remembered. "We are cold. We are sad."
"I am cold, too,"
he said. "I know, Carl," said Dead Boy. Then he realized. Dead Boy is his friend. He wanted to help him. That was why he'd been appearing. Carl's eyes were full of tears.
"Laurie won't talk to me,"
he told Dead Boy.
"It's like I'm dead, too."
Dead Boy nodded.
"I love her. How can I get her to talk to me again?"
"You have to show her that we're friends now."
"But how?"
"You have to help me finish the quest,"
Dead Boy whispered. Everything went dark, like the room was filled with black paint. Millions of crows. Carl was afraid.
"The quest?"
"You have to kill the final demon." Now it was just Dead Boy's eyes, like two big moons. "It's the priest, Carl. It's the Peterphile. He's the one who killed me."
"He is?"
Carl said. Dead Boy nodded slowly. Something was not right about this, but Carl shook it away. Everything glowed. "You have to show her."
"The holy fire,"
Mom said above the couch. Her hand was aflame, and Carl knew what he had to do. Father Green had intended to attend tonight's concert. if only out of a childish wish to irritate Greg. But at the very last minute, he had been called out to administer the last rites to an ailing woman on the other side of the city. He drove for an hour, only to find she had made a miraculous recovery. Father Green had no option but to concede the point to his rival. Well played, sir. When he returned, everyone had gone. The halls are empty, as he makes his way down to his basement office, where he will sit and watch the hands of the clock.
No work, Jerome. That's not like you. Getting old at last.
It has been like this since the boy died. He does not work. He does not sleep. You know he sees him still, in his office, dutifully folding cardboard sheets into boxes, taping shut the flaps, oblivious to the silent battle raging only a few feet away, the carnal ravenings of an old man. Even now, approaching Our Lady's Hall, Father Green thinks he hears footsteps behind him, and he cannot stop himself from a shiver of hope as he turns round. But of course there is nothing. At the top of the hall, he stops by the crib, as yet only half occupied. No infant, no kings, only the oxen and donkeys to keep watch over the holy parents as they kneel in the straw. Before it, the offerings for the hampers. He bends to examine the labels. Mascarpone cheese. Semi-sun-dried tomatoes. Lychees. Donations are down this year. The idea of giving food, of taking actual food from your larder and putting it in another's, must seem tiresomely Victorian in this ethereal age of numbers flying through the air. Poverty far too literal for these abstracted people.
That is not the reason, Jerome. The reason is you.
Yes. Father Green is aware of the rumours surrounding him. He sees the graffiti on his door. He hears the whispers, detects the snubs in the corridor, the staff room, the vestry even. All in all, it has pained him surprisingly little. The blessing of being an unsociable man, except that now it has taken away what power he had to do good. For how can a criminal tug at anyone's conscience? Who will give to a monster? He himself becomes the excuse not to think of those wretched slums, those addled lives. Irony upon irony. One always underestimates the capacity of life to diminish one.
So why do you stay?
He asks himself the same question as he descends the steps to the office. Why stay? He has given Greg his scapegoat. Scandal is averted. The swimming coach may make his escape unblemished. The school continue as a shining beacon of the bourgeoisie. What they need of him now is to go. Go, that they may curse his name and forget this ever happened. And he wants to go. He has done enough for Seabrook. Why stay? To be calumnied? To be painted with the sins of another?
It's obvious, Jerome. You wish the sin had been yours. That's why you will not tell the truth. That's why you will not leave. Instead, you must stay here and be punished. Yet, you committed no crime.
Only because I was afraid.
Ah, Jerome, come, it is over. The boy is in the ground with nothing to touch his lips but the worms. You have done him no wrong. Why must you torture yourself?
Why?
For Africa? For what happened 40 years ago? Who remembers, Jerome? Those little boys? Most likely they are dead, too. So who, then? God. But what God do you believe in any more?
The priest sits at his desk, leafs through the paperwork, unseeingly.
You would rather punish yourself than accept the alternative. Is that not so, Jerome?
That noise outside again. Footsteps?
None of this matters. That is what you will not accept. None of it has mattered. Nothing you did, the good, the bad. And nothing matters now.
Definitely something out there. A smell, too. Acrid. He rises, crosses the floor.
But you would rather burn than think this. You would rather hellfire than look at the world and see the truth. See nothing.
Tears, or the ache of tears that will not come. He opens the door. As the red flame leaps for him, he staggers backwards. Shock at first, but then a glimmer of joy. Hellfire. Howard stumbles out into December. The night, once it has slipped its fingers beneath his insulation of alcohol, is exceptionally cold, with a sour, chemical note to the air. He walks back in the direction of the school car park, deferring until he gets there the knowledge that he is unfit to drive and has not enough money for a taxi. His conscience taunts him with memories of the many times Hallie rescued him from comparable situations, driving across the whole city sometimes to pick him up, and he falls morosely into his fantasy of earlier on, calling at her door, attractively bloodied from his encounter with Tom Roach, to be swept up into her arms. Somehow, he doesn't think turning up unbruised, sacked, and drunk will have quite the same effect. The moon tonight is full, and bright enough that he notices it disappear when he turns in the gate. He looks up and sees an enormous black cloud printed over the school. It is of an unusual solidity, and low enough to partially obscure the tower. The very next moment, all the lights in the upper floors come on, and now he finds himself braced for it. The frenetic shrilling of the alarm clamors into the sleeping yard. Breaking into a run, he hurries down the avenue, through the car park, the dense black cloud growing over his head all the while, until, passing the sports hall, he arrives in the quad. The never-opened doors at the top of Our Lady's Hall have been flung open, and boys are pouring out like pajamaed ants from a disturbed nest, coils of black smoke snaking out with them at ankle height and slithering opportunistically into the night. Already the heat is palpable, a tropical warmth on his cheek. Bright, amorphous hands beat at the leaded glass of the windows, and from within comes a rapturous roar of destruction, mingled with crashes and breaking. Howard locates Brian Toms by the doors, hollering at the exiting boys to line up in order of their dorms.
"What's going on?"
he yells over the alarm.
"Fire."
Toms does not appear surprised to see Howard.
"Seems to have started in the basement. We've put in a call to the fire brigade, but it'll probably have eaten up the tower by the time they get here."
He speaks in calm, clipped tones, a general surveying his battlefield.
"Looks deliberate to me."
"Can I do anything?"
"We've got most of the boys out. These are just the last few."
As he speaks, the crocodile line begins to peter out, and Toms descends the steps to oversee the prefects as they do the head count. The boys, dim-eyed, tuft-haired, wait in orderly two-by-two rows. A few are filming the event with their phones, the white shapes behind the glass, like furious dancing ghosts. But most merely look on vacantly, as though attending a special midnight assembly, lending the scene a weird peace. Then it is broken by a commotion at the doors. Two fifth years struggle to contain a handful of smaller boys, who are apparently attempting to run back into the school. Toms runs over to help the prefects, and as they are jostled out into the quad, Howard identifies the breakaways as Jeff Sproke, Dennis Hoey, and Mario Bianchi from his second year history class. The tears on their cheeks, in the unearthly light, give their faces the appearance of melting wax.
"He's still in there!"
blurts Jeff Sproke from behind the chain of arms.
"He's not!"
Toms shouts him down.
"He's not! We checked!"
As he speaks, a plume of fire shoots over the roof, bathing the onlookers in a freakish orange glow.
Ruprecht! Ruprecht!
The boys' friends cry, throwing themselves once more against their captors. The sound is pitiful and thin against the flames, like kittens crying for their mother. With a sinking heart, Howard reels around and stumbles towards the doors. Heat blasts his face. Beneath its bandages, his hand sings ecstatically, as if recognizing its own. Burning, Our Lady's Hall has become something alive, something new and terrible. Flames race over the walls, seizing and devouring, and the dull matrix of the school beneath them, the chipped timber, the shabby plasterwork, the doorways, the desks, the statue of the Virgin, seems already to have retreated from the world, half turned to shadow. Looking on, Howard feels like a dinosaur, watching the first meteors fall, like he's witnessing an evolutionary leap, the arrival of an insuperable future. He imagines Greg's tropical fish boiling in their tank. Toms appears by his side at the threshold. Howard looks back at him in a daze.
We have to do something.
There's no one in there,
Toms says.
We checked all the dorms.
Then where's Van Doren?
Toms does not reply.